when the Buddha was alive, we know that there were many occasions when people would see the Buddha for the first time and immediately develop confidence in the Buddha just from seeing him. We know that the Buddha didn't look like an ordinary being. He was extremely handsome, extremely beautiful, had bright, clear, golden skin. He even had special marks on his body that ordinary people didn't have, that the bump that we see on the top of the head and this tuft of white hair on the forehead. So some people, as soon as they saw the Buddha, they realized that he was a special person. They saw that he had a very calm, peaceful demeanor, and they were interested in that. They got curious and caught by that, just by seeing the Buddha. But we definitely know that that wasn't how everybody reacted when they saw the Buddha. Some people, when they saw the Buddha, got very angry or criticized him. Maybe they just saw that he was a monk, and a lot of people didn't like monks in the time of the Buddha. We shouldn't think that just because now in Buddhist countries most people really like seeing monks. Even in this country, you know, many people are very happy to see monks walking around. We go for walks here outside the monastery, and many people will wave, or somebody gave us the peace sign today, had to explain what that meant to the other monks. Some people will even know to put their hands in Anjali like this. But that's not always the case. In the time of the Buddha, there were many people who didn't like monks. There were lots of different kinds of monks in the time of the Buddha. They weren't all disciples of the Buddha, and some of them weren't very ethical. So today we'll get to listen to a very short sermon that the Buddha gave to a man who was not one of these people who immediately, when he saw the Buddha, he had a happy mind. He had a very different reaction. So the discourse begins, "Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was dwelling among the Magadhans at Dakshinagiri, near the Brahmin village of Ekanalala. Now on that occasion, the Brahmin Kasi Bharadvaja the plowman, had 500 plows fastened to their yokes at the time of sowing." So we know that in the time of the Buddha, there were these very distinct social classes. And the Brahmins felt that they were at the top of the heap. They were the hereditary priestly caste. So it was their job to memorize the Vedas, the early Hindu scriptures, and to perform special rituals and ceremonies for people. There were the kings, the rulers, the soldiers. There were businessmen, business people. There were workers, manual laborers, craftspeople. And there were people even living outside of that system, very, very low. And in fact, the Brahmins felt that these people going about as monks and nuns, that they fell into the lowest category, the people outside of the system, even below the lowest workers. And so even though the Brahmins were the religious caste, many of them had large tracts of land, were very wealthy, and had to look after farming and things like that on their land. So we hear that there's this certain Brahmin named Kasi Bharadvaja, and he has everything set up to plow his really large large holding of land. So then in the morning, the Blessed One, dressed and taking bowl and robe, went to the place where the Brahmin Kasi Bharadvaja was at work. So this was the habit even of the Buddha, that along with the other monks, sometimes alone, he would go into the city, go into the villages, and collect alms food. That the Buddha designed this system so the monks and nuns wouldn't need to worry about having jobs to earn a living, to feed themselves, to shelter themselves. That he said that monks and nuns should make do with the most basic of things, that they shouldn't have lots of needs, they shouldn't be hard to support, and that if no one invites them to come for a meal, or no one says that they'll bring food to the monastery, that we're just to take our bowl and go through the city or the village and allow people to put food into the bowl. Even in this country, it's possible to do this. It's a little more difficult than in Buddhist countries. You have to go where the people are. But even today, it's possible still to collect food in that way. So the Buddha understood that by living in this way, monks and nuns could get a lot of benefit from this, that they could give up their attachment to having certain kinds of foods, right? They could give up their attachment to having certain kinds of clothing, that they would make do with just whatever people gave them. And in this way, also giving people the opportunity to give and giving people the opportunity to come in contact directly with monks and nuns, to ask questions, to hear the teachings. So then it continues. And the Buddha, actually, he gave a very beautiful simile. I've mentioned it before, I think, of a bee that goes from flower to flower. And as it goes from flower to flower, it's going there with a purpose, right? It's trying to drink the nectar. But the bee never destroys the flower, right? Some insects do destroy flowers. They eat the flowers. But a bee just goes and it sucks up the nectar. The nectar is sort of extra for the flower. It doesn't need it for anything other than to get the bee there. And when the bee goes there, it collects some pollen and it spreads the pollen from flower to flower. The bee just takes a little bit from each flower, right? It doesn't have to go to just one single flower, get its whole meal and be done, right? Just gets a little here, a little there, a little here, a little there. So the Buddha said, in the same way, monks and nuns can get a little bit from lots of different people. That it's never a burden. Just like it's never a burden to the flower, it's never a burden when monks and nuns just collect little bits from families, house to house. Or if people bring food to the monastery, right? Different people bring different days. So it's not a burden. And just like the bee helps the flower by spreading the pollen, the monks and nuns get to spread the Dhamma, spread the teachings to people who support them. So now on that occasion, the Brahmin Kasi Bharadvaja's food distribution was taking place. So maybe he was giving out food to his employees, to his workers, or sometimes people would also give out food to the elderly, people who didn't have families to support them, or people who were sick or disabled. Lots of reasons that people would give away alms food. So then the Blessed One approached the place of the food distribution and stood to one side. The Brahmin Kasi Bharadvaja saw the Blessed One standing for alms and said to him, "Recluse." And so this is a word, in English we say recluse. It's it's kind of the most impolite way that you can address a monk or a nun. There's no sign of respect. It's not absolutely an insult. There are other insulting things. People would call them bald-headed, say, "You baldy," right? That's more insulting, and people would say that as well. But here he addresses him not as Venerable Sir, not as the Blessed One. He just says, "You recluse, you wanderer." He says, "I plow and sow, and when I have plowed and sown, I eat. You too, ascetic, ought to plow and sow, and then when you have plowed and sown, you will eat." So, he's not inspired by the sight of the Buddha. He's not happy to see someone, a religious person, coming for alms. In fact, he says to the Buddha, "Hey, I earn my living, right? I plow and I sow, and because I do that, I get to eat. You should also do that," right? He doesn't say it, but he can see that the Buddha is not disabled. He's strong. He could plow and sow and tend a field. So he says to him, "You should do the same. You know, why are you coming here begging for food from me?" And so the Buddha says to him, "I too, Brahman, plow and sow, and when I have plowed and sown, I eat." So this is a very interesting thing. So we know that the Buddha didn't have land. We know that the Buddha laid down a rule that his monks and nuns weren't even allowed to dig in the soil. We're not allowed to dig in the soil. We're not allowed to cut or damage plants in any way. But still he says, "I plow and sow, and when I plow and sow, I eat." So the Buddha wasn't lying. He would say things like this from time to time, knowing that it would arouse curiosity in people, and knowing that he could explain a meaning, a figurative meaning, about the statement. So the Brahmin, he bites. He says, "But we do not see Master Gotama's yoke or plow or plowshare or goad, the stick, or oxen. Yet Master Gotama says, 'I too, Brahman, plow and sow, and when I have plowed and sown, I eat.'" Then the Brahman, Kasi Bharadvaja, addressed the Blessed One in verse. So the English translation doesn't really sound like poetry or a verse, but in the original Pali language it would have had a meter to it, and been composed in a very beautiful way. So he says, "You claim to be a man who works the plow, but I do not see your plowing. If you're a plowman, answer me, how should we understand your plowing?" So he's clever. He already sees that there must be some deeper meaning. And so the Buddha, the Blessed One, says to him, he also replies to him in verse. He says, "Faith is the seed, austerity the rain, wisdom my yoke and plow. Shame is the pole, mind is the yoke tie, mindfulness my plowshare and goad." So, very deep meaning here. He mentions all these parts that a farmer needs to work with, but he gives a very different meaning to each of them. So he says, "Faith is the seed." Very beautiful idea here. A farmer without seeds can do absolutely nothing. Right? You're not a farmer if you don't at least start out with a seed. Right? Maybe you tend plants that grow year after year, but initially you need a seed. You need something to start out that growing. The Buddha said, Sraddha is the seed. Faith is the seed. Many people will think that they're praising the Buddha's teachings when they say, there's no such thing as faith in Buddhism. It's not a faith-based religion. But here the Buddha's saying, faith, it's the most fundamental thing. Without that, nothing else grows. Right? If we don't have this idea that the Buddha had something to teach us, we'd never come. We'd never take the effort to come and learn the teachings. Right? Even if someone doesn't have a lot of faith, right? It's that belief that there's something good to hear that gets them in the door. It gets them to open up the book. It gets them to start thinking, right? Just like from, and that that seed, very small. Usually seeds are very, very small. And when we just look at one seed, it doesn't seem like it would do anything for us, right? But when that seed has the right conditions, it sometimes even a very small seed can grow into a huge plant that can feed many, many people if all the conditions are correct, right? That without that little bit of belief, we don't investigate. We don't even try and practice the teachings, right? Maybe, so all the people in the world who don't think that there's anything to be gained from meditation, right? They don't have any faith in meditation. Do they ever sit down and close their eyes and meditate? Never, right? People who don't have any faith in ethical behavior, right? Do they give up the easy ways of life that involve breaking the precepts? No. Right? So many of the instructions that the Buddha gives us, we can't see the benefit right away. If we could see the benefit right away from all of the Buddha's teachings, right, everybody would not take a breath without following the Buddha's teachings. But many of these things we can't see, right? Many of the things that the Buddha saw, especially on the night of his enlightenment, they're not something that can be seen with a mind that's still filled with greed, with hatred, with delusion, right? This ability that he had to recollect his previous lives, right? With our minds, we can hardly remember last week, right, or last year, right? Can we even remember what the sermon was about last week that we heard at the monastery, right? Because our mind isn't developed, because we have all these layers of problems that block the mind from being really clear and bright, right? The Buddha said the mind is luminous. Its true nature is to be very bright and clear, but it's covered over with all these problems. Right? While we're still in that situation of having all these problems, we can't see for ourselves that the mind is bright and luminous. We only know the mind with the problems that it can cause, right? The worry and the fear and the anxiety. So someone tells us, no, you do this meditation and your mind, it'll start to become clear. It'll start to become calm. It'll start to become concentrated. Right? Maybe we have a little bit of faith and so we try, but then we sit down and our mind goes all over the place. And so we say, nope, mind can't do that. Right? So we had a little bit of faith, but not enough. So without this confidence that the Buddha knew something beyond what we can know for ourselves right away, very hard to grow good spiritual qualities, very hard to give up the pleasure that comes from material things, right? Because that pleasure is something that we can see right away. But the the pleasure and happiness that comes from developing the mind, that's something that it takes faith to believe that, that the work that we do is going to pay off. So the Buddha says, faith is the seed and austerity the rain. So in Pali, this word for austerity is tapas. So this is the word that was often used for these very severe ascetic practices that, that people used in the time of the Buddha. They thought that through doing these things to torture the body, they would burn away their bad qualities. Right? So when the Buddha uses this word, he's not using austerity in that same way. He's talking about this practice of renunciation, this giving up, this being content with what we have, right? That when we do these practices that he gave us, it waters the seed, right? When we come together and observe the eight precepts, right, taking on these extra practices of renunciation, it waters the seed of faith. It allows us to get a glimpse that we can do without some of the things that we think are the cause of our happiness. Right? And it may be difficult. Right? It may be something that without faith we would never consider doing. But as we do these things, it helps the seed to grow. Wisdom is my yoke and plow. So this idea of the plow, right? It goes through and it breaks up the soil, right? That it's it's wisdom that helps us break up this wrong view that we have of the world. Right, we like to view these senses as something that it's a source of constant pleasure. We like to view this body as ours, as something that's going to last, something that's going to bring us happiness. But when we apply wisdom to those thoughts, we see that it breaks them up. That this holding on that we have, it just causes us pain and suffering eventually. So wisdom is another one of these conditions that helps to prepare the seed for growing, right? Without plowing up the soil, you put that seed just on the top of the soil, it doesn't grow, right? Without wisdom to break up these wrong ideas that we have about the world, very hard for spiritual qualities to develop. He says, shame is the pole, mind the yoke tie. So here, shame, it's not the same idea of shame as we usually think. It's shame as a helpful spiritual quality. So when the Buddha talks about shame, It's purely a wholesome quality. It's purely a beneficial idea. This idea that we have this innate fear of doing wrong things, sort of like conscience, having a conscience. This innate sense that we should avoid doing things that hurt other people, and we should do things that help others, right? That when we have that. Wholesome, healthy sense of conscience, it keeps us guided. And mind the yoke tie. So it's this mind that we use, to do these things, right? Without the mind, we can't develop wisdom, right? We can't have faith. Mind is the thing that ties all these together. He says, mindfulness, my plowshare, and goad. So, you know, the goad is the thing that you hit the cow with to keep him walking, right? That mindfulness, the Buddha talked about as a wholesome quality. It's not simply being aware of what's happening, right? Nowadays, mindfulness has gotten kind of watered down into this notion that it's just about paying attention to what's happening in the present moment. But when the Buddha talked about mindfulness, he was talking about right mindfulness, sammasati, right? That we, it has this element of wisdom to it, that we see, you know, because if we're just aware of the body, there's no wisdom in that. When we're aware of the body thinking, this is my body, this body is going to bring me happiness, this body is going to last forever, that's wrong mindfulness. That's paying attention to the body incorrectly. Wrong mindfulness. When we pay attention to the body thinking, this body, it's made up of conditioned things. It's made up of these different organs, these different parts. It's composed of the four elements, right? It's going to one day be a corpse rotting in the earth. That's right mindfulness. Because we're looking at the real nature of the body. We're seeing that the happiness that comes from the body, it's just a temporary thing. That when we look at the body incorrectly, right, with wrong mindfulness, leads to suffering. But when we look at the body with right mindfulness, it only leads to happiness, right, to a letting go, to a giving up of attachments. So it's a nice idea to think of this mindfulness as a stick, right? Because if you know, people will say that, you know, because even nowadays they have workshops for soldiers, right, to teach them mindfulness meditation, right? So maybe as they're aiming their gun, they're mindful, right? Not right, that's not what the Buddha was talking about, right? Not right mindfulness. So, he says, guarded in body, guarded in speech, controlled in my appetite for food. I use truth as my weeding hook and gentleness as my unyoking. So, he's, as we say in the puja, he's not attached to beautiful objects to look at, to delicious food, to beautiful sounds, right? His senses are restrained. And truth is what he uses to pull the weeds out, right? Another very beautiful idea, right? That that our mind is like this field with all kinds of wrong ideas about things, right? And that we use truth to go through and pick each one of those out. We have these ideas that our family, right, should always love us, that people should always treat us kindly, that our happiness should last forever, that we should be healthy until we die, and to be able to enjoy all of our things, right? But when we look truthfully, we see, yeah, that's actually not true, right? These ideas that, you know, my children will live longer than I will and take care of me when I get old, right? All kinds of wrong ideas in the mind based on based on this delusion, right? That things are permanent. That we're not going to be separated from our loved ones. He says, energy, my beast of burden, carrying me to security from bondage. It goes ahead without stopping, to where, having gone, one does not sorrow. So, energy, right effort. Without that, we can't practice. Without the effort to give up unwholesome habits, to prevent new unwholesome habits from developing, without the effort to develop good habits in the mind, without the habit to perfect the good habits that we already have, there's no spiritual path, right? There's just sort of going along with things. That without making the effort, we don't develop, right? Without making the effort to learn the teachings, to apply the teachings to our own lives, without making the effort to give up breaking the precepts, to make the effort to keep the precepts, without making the effort to practice meditation, to constantly be bringing the mind back to the object. No practice, nothing without effort. He says it goes ahead without stopping to where, having gone, one does not sorrow. So where's that? Nibbana, enlightenment. That's what he's talking about. That this effort leads us to a place where we're free from suffering, right? Where all attachment has been given up. He says, in such a way, this plowing is done, which has the deathless as its fruit. So the deathless is another name for enlightenment, Nibbana, because when one attains Nibbana, after this life, they never die again, never have that suffering of birth and death. Having finished this work of plowing, one is released from all suffering. So when the Brahmin heard these things, he was very happy. It was what he needed to hear to change his mind, to maybe start to have some of this faith in the Buddha, to see that these monks and nuns wandering around could be practicing something very valuable, could be growing great spiritual qualities that lead to an incredible harvest of happiness. So he says to the Buddha, he says, let Master Gotama eat. So this time he refers in a much more respectful way. He says, the worthy is a plowman. So the arahant is a plowman. Since Master Gotama does plowing, that even has the deathless as its fruit. So his mind is totally turned around. And he says, yes, you're doing the kind of farming that leads to the best results, to the best fruit. And so then the Buddha, so he says to the Buddha, okay, go ahead and eat. Now it's okay for you to eat. Before you couldn't, but now you can go ahead and eat, right? With a good heart. So when this happened, and it happened several times on different occasions, the Buddha said also in verse, food over which verses have been sung is not fit to be eaten by me. This Brahman is not the principle observed by those who see, so observed by the Buddhas. The enlightened ones reject such food over which verses have been sung. As such a principle exists, O Brahman, this is their rule of conduct. Serve with other food and drink, the consummate one, the great seer, with taints destroyed and remorse stilled, for he is the field for one seeking merit. So, so this idea that, and even in English we have the phrase "sing for your supper," right? The idea that that the Buddha is performing and preaching the Dhamma so people will feed him, right? It's totally against the principle of of the Buddha's method, right? He doesn't give these verses so people will feed him. He gives the Dhamma freely. And so he said to the Brahmin, you know, he didn't actually say it, but the Brahmin had his chance, right, with that food. But the Buddha says, no, no, you can't feed me that food now. If you want to feed me, that's fine. You can make some food and give it to me. But it doesn't work that way with Buddhas. And so this wasn't upsetting to the Brahmin. In fact, it made him very happy. He said, magnificent Master Gotama, magnificent Master Gotama. The Dhamma has been made clear in many ways by Master Gotama, as though he were turning upright what had been turned upside down, revealing what was hidden, shown the way to one who was lost, holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go for refuge to Master Gotama and to the Dhamma and to the Bhikkhu Sangha. Let Master Gotama remember me as a lay follower who from today has gone for refuge for life. So hearing these few words was enough to change this Brahmin's mind completely. Right? He saw the Buddha's wisdom and right away on the spot declared that he was a disciple of the Buddha. So we too have had the opportunity to hear these very beautiful verses. We can find this incident, this discourse, in this collection called the Samyutta Nikaya. It's in one of the first chapters. All sorts of discussions that the Buddha had with Brahmins. And many of them did not start out well. A lot of drama in that chapter, because a lot of the Brahmins weren't so happy with the Buddha. He wasn't part of their caste, right? He didn't have this birthright of religious practice. And so many of them were not too keen on him. But in all the cases, the Buddha was able to teach to them in a way that they gained confidence in his teachings and in his own enlightenment. So today we had the opportunity to hear these very beautiful verses preached by the Buddha. We got to learn how faith is the seed, the starting point for all these wholesome qualities that we want to develop in our minds. We got to see how beneficial restraint is, how this healthy sense of conscience is so beneficial, how through this practice, through this right effort, through this right mindfulness, we are following the path that leads one day to full enlightenment. So having heard these teachings, may we keep them in mind, may we investigate these teachings, and may we lead our lives according to these instructions. Through the power of this merit, may we one day realize the supreme bliss of Nibbana in this Gautama Buddha's dispensation. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.